Hello, Cast of Kings listeners, it's David Chen. Hope you're all well, and thanks for joining us for House of the Dragon this season. You may or may not be aware that A Cast of Kings is part of the Decoding TV podcast network, which also includes the Decoding TV flagship podcast. That podcast is covering other TV shows that I think y'all might be interested in, and I wanted to share with you an episode in which we cover one of those TV shows. It's called The White Lotus. We just kicked off our coverage of The White Lotus this week on Decoding TV with a brand new co-host who you will hear from momentarily. But I wanted to share our intro episode with you all. This is us talking about season one of The White Lotus, getting excited for season two of The White Lotus, which debuts this Sunday. And if you want to hear more conversations like this one, please do give us a subscribe at podcast.decodingtv.com. One last thing, it is not my plan to drop a bunch of podcast episodes on this feed from other shows, but every once in a while, if there's a show that I think people on here will like, I will put a podcast episode in the feed. There's going to be at least one more in the next couple weeks that I think you'll all enjoy. But otherwise, feel free to ignore and look forward to our bonus episode for A Cast of Kings coming next week. Thanks so much for listening. Here is the Decoding TV podcast episode spoiling everything for season one of The White Lotus and looking forward to season two of The White Lotus. If you want to hear more, subscribe at podcast.decodingtv.com. Enjoy.
The goal is to disappear behind our masks as pleasant, interchangeable helpers. It's tropical kabuki.
Aloha.
A happy to be here.
We're on our honeymoon.
You're such valued guests.
Welcome to the White Lotus.
Are they bigger?
Nicole, they're fucking huge.
I haven't seen them in a while.
It's cancer.
Swole balls.
Did they biopsy your balls, Dad?
Not yet.
Mom! Am I interrupting? I know it's only your honeymoon. Oh my God, look at her face.
Rachel, you were such a beautiful bride, but also very pale. But now you have a little more color and it looks great.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I'm David Chen, and today is very exciting. We're launching our coverage of a brand new television show. I'm pleased to announce that Decoding TV will be covering The White Lotus Season 2. Now, I was really impressed with The White Lotus when it first started airing in July of 2021 on HBO. The title of the show refers to a fictional luxury resort that has locations all around the world, and the show invited us into the lives of characters that worked for or were visiting The White Lotus, some of whom were delightfully quirky while others had a darker side, but all of them were tortured in one way or another. Beyond just being a lot of fun to watch, the show also featured some biting commentary about the hypocrisy and obliviousness of wealthy people. I wasn't the only one who loved the show. It was massively buzzed about, critically acclaimed, and it went on to be nominated for 20 Emmy Awards, eventually winning 5 of them, including for Outstanding Directing and Outstanding Writing. The show's first season consisted of 6 episodes. Its second season will debut on October 30th on HBO and run for 7 episodes. We'll be recapping and reviewing every single one of those 7 episodes. Here to join me as my co-host for those 7 episodes, she is a TV critic at Vulture.com. And one of my favorite writers on the internet today, Roxana Haddadi, welcome to Decoding TV.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to talk about this show with you.
I am excited as well. I want to talk to you about The White Lotus Season 1. That's what the purpose of this episode is going to be. We're going to talk about The White Lotus Season 1, reflect on our thoughts, specifically talk about the finale and where we left off with that episode. But before I get to that, I just want to mention you can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com and follow us on Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube at decodingtv. If you're interested to support this podcast, you can also become a paid member at decodingtv.com where you can find ad-free episodes as well as get early access to episodes. Roxana Haddadi, you reviewed The White Lotus Season 1 for RogerEbert.com, and in your review, you wrote that it was, quote, alternately hilarious and unsettling. The White Lotus isn't a feel-good watch, but it is a must-watch, end quote. Roxana, why was it a must-watch for you?
I think it was a must-watch for me because, as you mentioned, it was so biting. It felt like it was really digging deep into this idea of, does money make you happy? Does it make life easier? How do those things sort of intersect? I mean, I think the idea of class consciousness in Hollywood productions feels sort of inherently hypocritical because these shows are coming from people who are wealthy and perhaps more well off than us and have more access. But I thought that this show actually had something to say about how all of that sort of changes who you are and how access to it changes who you are. So I really liked all of that narrative content and the sense that the show had a distinct point of view. And then it also benefited from having this amazing ensemble, right? I mean, Jennifer Coolidge was amazing. Connie Britton was amazing. We're very used to Jake Lacy as sort of a rom-com, goofy sort of figure, and he was very threatening and sort of ominous in this. So I think also the cast really helped in sort of make these stories come real. And just on a very small note, I really liked the terrible college students. They were probably my favorite. And I loved how often they wore like Rage Against the Machine t-shirts. Just middle school me was very pleased by that.
Yeah, yeah. Some great points there. I agree with you. When I was watching the show, part of me was wondering, how close are these actual people in real life to the characters that they play? Because here's the thing. The thing with being an actor in Hollywood is it's kind of weird because sometimes you can make $5,000 in a year or sometimes you can make $5 million in a year. And it's just like, there's just such a vast range. So there is this kind of potentially meta commentary of like, are these people playing some version of themselves? And I agree with you that there is some sort of tension there where Mike White is presumably a fairly wealthy white dude, but he's making a show that is meant to critique people of his class. And how meaningful can that critique be if it comes from someone of that class, right? At the same time, I do think it does a pretty good job of making rich people look pretty terrible, you know, and not only just making them look bad generically, but like the specific blind spots that rich people or wealthy people or privileged people can often have, I think it does a great job of illuminating. And as you point out, the ensemble is amazing, and it's just fun to watch like beautiful people, you know, be awkward around each other and kind of have like terrible, painful conflict with each other. You know, that's a fun, zesty enterprise. So I really like the show in general as well and found it to be like compelling, must-watch TV. Also, loved the soundtrack and score. I thought those were like really evocative and kind of inextricably tied to the show. So very, very credits. Memorable stuff. Yeah, opening credits, really good stuff.
Yeah, the opening credits are amazing that we're seeing this initially sort of welcoming tropical wallpaper that then eventually transforms into sort of a location of rot and corruption and sort of things falling apart. I really loved that. I also think that it sort of hit us at a time post-Parasite, when people were more interested in these kind of commentary sort of projects. I believe it was pre-Squid Game, right? So I think that we were in this time where people were sort of willing to see what these stories had to offer. And this one was just really well done in a variety of different ways.
Yeah, totally. So we both loved The White Lotus Season 1. We will see if The White Lotus Season 2 can live up to The White Lotus Season 1, or if it's going to be more maybe like a True Detective Season 2 type situation.
A Big Little Lies Season 2.
A Big Little Lies situation. You know, there's many ways this could go right and wrong. So that is the journey we will go on together on Decoding TV, and I'm really excited that Roxana Haddadi is here for it. Now, before we get into Season 2, Episode 1, which will happen next week, and I do want to just point out that in general, you can expect episodes to drop recapping that week's episode of The White Lotus within 48 hours after the show airs on television. If you are a DecodingTV.com paid member, you might get it a little bit earlier than that, but that's kind of generally what you can expect. But just wanted to let you know what our scheduling will be. But let's talk about where we left off with Season 1. Now, The White Lotus is an anthology series, so we are unlikely to see any of these characters except for one show up next season. Jennifer Coolidge, who plays Tanya McQuaid. She is has already been announced to be in Season 2. So she's going to be like our one line of continuity between Seasons 1 and 2. But presumably Season 2 will be at a different resort of the White Lotus and it will have a whole new cast of characters. That said, I just wanted to kind of refresh people's memories about some of the stuff that happened in Season 1. So let's talk about some of the main plot lines in season one. One of the biggest plot lines in season one was around the Pattons. Shane Patton, played by Jake Lacy, who is a real estate agent, and his wife, newlywed wife, Rachel Patton, played by Alexandra Daddario. And Shane Patton is basically the customer from hell this season, right? He is, yes. What is a male version of a Karen? You know, he's the person that's like literally complains to see the manager virtually every episode.
About
things,
everything.
You know, things aren't perfect for his honeymoon, so he's really, really upset about it. So that is Shane's storyline, and Rachel's storyline is one of realizing, you know, right around the time when Shane invites his mom, played by Molly Shannon, to the honeymoon, that perhaps Rachel has made a terrible mistake in wedding this person who is basically a man-child. I thought this is a great plot line. I mean, the thing about Shane Patton, in my opinion, is he is clearly, like, very a distasteful person, like, but I don't know if I would quite describe him as morally reprehensible, just because his actions, I think many of us have at some point had some, I'm not accusing us of being like Shane Patton, but I'm saying at one point in our lives, we have probably had a feeling that is similar to something that Shane Patton expresses in season one of the show. Would you say that is reasonable, Roxana? And what did you think of the Shane and Rachel storyline overall?
I feel like I'm making so many faces because I think that he was the most morally reprehensible.
Oh, he's certainly the most. He's certainly the most.
Yeah, I think that what was really well done about this storyline is it is so clear from the very beginning that Shane thinks he's someone that is guaranteed different treatment because of the money that he has, right? But he also isn't someone who is classy. That maybe that's mean, but I think he's someone who has a lot of money and who sort of thinks that he's owed certain things because he has a lot of money. But I don't think that he has actual preferences. I think he just sees the most expensive thing and thinks that's the best and thinks that he deserves it. So I think there's a lot of layers of how privileged he is. And then it's wonderful when Molly Shannon enters and plays his mom because you realize, oh, he became that way because she is 100% that way. So I think it was a good way to show us how these sort of toxic characteristics are generational. And then I was really impressed with Daddario in this. I mean, we mentioned True Detective. I think one of her probably breakout things was she was on season one of True Detective and she was very good in a supporting role. But I think she does really exceptional work here communicating a woman who is trapped and trapped by her own choices, right? I mean, she sort of got swept off her feet by this man. She knew she wasn't really cutting it as a writer or a journalist. And he sort of offered her a way out. And now she's realizing maybe it would have been better if I didn't do this. So I think she's the most tragic, sort of empathetic character in this whole thing. And I really liked their dynamic. I mean, a lot of their scenes are in the resort, sort of eating together and just being very tense. And it never feels like honeymoon. Vibe is off the entire time. And I think that really helped us know from the beginning, okay, this is who these people are going to be. This is what their energy is. And it's all bad. And we're just going to go on this journey with them.
Really great points. I guess let me try to revise what I was saying about Shane. You know, I think...
Because I was like, you're wrong.
No. I mean, he's clearly awful. Like, he's clearly horrible. Yeah. But I think I would... the point I was trying to make was I don't think he was, like, cartoonishly evil is kind of what I was trying to say. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that I think the show creator, Mike White, like, made him just relatable enough...
Yeah.
That you could kind of see from his perspective. But I agree. I started by saying he's a nightmare customer, totally awful. Like, when he's interacting with hotel staff, your sympathy is always with hotel staff.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you can kind of see, like, if you, like, squint and look askance at what he's doing, that, like, oh, on some level, he just wants what he feels he's owed. And even though it's really 85 to 95% for him, there is a part of it that is also for his wife, right? Even though he doesn't see, even though he doesn't recognize her full personhood, there is still, at least he has told himself that, like, his actions are for his wife to some degree. So I'm not saying he's a good person. I'm not saying he is sympathetic, but I think that the show did give him enough outs to make it seem like he is on some levels doing things for the right reason. But
and I think you're completely right that the show very smartly begins his character arc with a mistake that someone else made, right? Like, all of his reactions are over the top. But when they arrive at the resort, he is correct that he booked a different, more expensive, better suite. And the resort tries to trick him and lie to him and tell him that he didn't do that. So I think from a black and white, who was right, who was wrong situation, Shane was right. But then every way that he reacts to that mistake is what just digs him into more and more of a sort of ethically awful trench.
Right. And I think you made a great point about this idea of him being kind of nouveau riche. Like, it's not even like he really wants the accoutrement of the pineapple suite or anything like that. Like, it's not like he is like, oh, I just loved it last time I was here. Like, he just loves the idea of it.
Yes.
But, you know, ultimately the big thing that happens with Rachel is she ends up going back to Shane at the end. I don't know if you saw that coming. I thought it could have gone either way. And you're obviously rooting for her to break away from this. But at the end of the day, she chooses class and safety over her own autonomy and self-determination. And as you said, it's quite tragic. Any thoughts on Rachel's ending in this season?
I mean, I think Rachel's ending is very haunting. I think there's another ending that we'll get to that's very haunting. And I think they sort of exist in opposition to each other. I mean, the issue with this is that Rachel realizes that she is capable of a different life, right? I mean, she doesn't need to be married to him. She doesn't need to deal with this. No one is forcing her hand. But the decision, the decision to go back to him is sort of giving up on yourself, right? I mean, she sort of sees what the possibilities are. She would have to work. I mean, God, who wants to work? She would have to work.
Who wants to work for like a pop culture website? I mean, come
horrible.
On. No.
Yeah, absolutely not.
I kid. You know? I kid.
Yes, of course.
I love Roxana's work at Vulture, FYI.
Okay, well, thank you. That's very kind. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, like, all these things, like, as terrible as he is, she's still at this beautiful resort. And as terrible as his mother is, she would still have a very easy sort of life. So I think that decision, I don't want to say a lot of us would make, but some of us would make. Certainly a lot of people have made. But I just think that Daddario gives that character enough sort of vulnerability and enough surrender that I can't judge her for that. It's just like, well, I mean, I feel sorry for you, but I guess that's a choice you made yourself. So, yeah, just very haunting. Very tragic.
When they embrace at the end, it's a very sad, tragic fate for that character.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely still would like read her name in the news and be like, ugh, this woman. But at this moment in time, I feel sorry for what she's decided to do.
You're saying when she becomes kind of a sort of a rich housewife of trophy wife, like you would see her being photographed, you know, coming out of the most expensive restaurant in town and you would roll your eyes.
Yes.
But at this moment in the show that you're intersecting with her, you feel sympathy.
Yeah, in this liminal space, I'm like, I feel very sorry for what you're going through.
Wow.
But I like that you like
made a whole life for her. You made a whole life for her, like, beyond the confines of the show.
Yes.
All right, so that is the Pattons' really well-done storyline. And this is the thing, like, virtually every character in the show has some kind of arc.
Yes.
And that's really hard to do, but I think the show did a great job of giving each character some kind of arc. You know, some of them are mini arcs, some of them are barely an arc, but all the characters get some kind of arc. Unless they're people of color, in which case you see them for like a few episodes and then you never see them again.
Well, unless they're Hawaiian natives, and then yes. It's like, oh, we can't, yeah. we can't take the time.
Not enough time in the show for those people.
Sorry.
It is true that I do think that is a huge weak spot of the show.
Yeah.
Characters like Lonnie from the first episode, Kai, like once they do their thing and make their impression, like they perform their plot function, they're basically never heard from again. Which is kind of a bummer for a show that one would think is interrogating the idea of privilege. But anyway,
I think, well, yeah. We can briefly speak to this. I mean,
yes, go ahead.
It's hard because I think the show, and Mike White would say, I think he did say in interviews, that we are seeing the perspective of the guests, right? So why would you sort of follow Lonnie in the rest of her life? And why would you know what happens to the employee that Paula sort of has this affair/planned heist with? And on the one hand, I get that. On the other hand, I do feel like it sort of feels like a little bit of a justification for not writing these stories to be like, oh, well, I mean, the point is that they get to leave. It's like, right, I get that. But there could have been a little bit more for these characters to sort of elucidate further what is tourism, right? I mean, like, what are these places forced into and how do you have to become a product to survive in a classist system? And I think the show could have gone further on that.
Yeah, it was interesting to read and hear about Mike, the criticism to the show on those regards, mm-hmm. right? And also like read Mike White's responsibility. And, you know, the show does kind of directly address it. But like, what is the place of the white male in modern right. society? And I think there is this sense from people like Mike White that it's like, I don't know if there is a place, you know? And I think he is understanding of the criticism and is accepting of it. But I do think that there is this kind of... I did find there to be kind of the lack of acknowledgement of the potential idea that someone like Mike White could use his position and considerable resources and clout to like elevate people who might be more underrepresented in Hollywood, yeah. right? I think he wrote and directed all the episodes, right? But it's like, you know, there's probably opportunities to like give other people, you know, the directing job that for the show that he's show running. So anyway, it did feel, there's a few things about season one that rubbed me the wrong way, but it's like, hey, I still like the show. I'm still into the show, you know? But we've touched upon a few of those things. The Mosbachers. Nicole Mosbacher is played by Connie Britton, who is the CFO of a search engine company, kind of a Sheryl Sandberg type.
Yeah, right? A very lean-in sort of tech wife type.
Yes, yes.
The Laura Dern of Big Little Lies.
Gotcha. Yes, that's right. Yeah. And her husband is Mark Mosbacher, played by Steve Zahn. Her daughter is Olivia. Olivia's friend is Paula, played by Brittany O'Grady. And they also have a son named Quinn Mosbacher, played by Fred Hechinger. So,
yeah. And Olivia is Sydney Sweeney. I don't know if we mentioned
yes,
that.
Yes, 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 yes. So this was a kind of interesting storyline. Like, you know, all the storylines were pretty good. I think the character that probably goes on the biggest, the characters that go on the biggest journeys are Quinn and like Paula and Olivia, I think, right?
I think less Olivia, more so Quinn
yeah.
and Paula, yeah.
Quinn really was kind of a tragic figure in some ways as well because he is also suffering in a rich family.
Mm-hmm.
Because people literally don't listen to anything he says or any of his opinions or what he wants, right?
Not at all.
He basically doesn't have personhood in his family. And
no.
Like you see it like in every single scene, he will say like, I want to do this. And like no one listens to him or cares what he has to say. And it's very, very sad. I mean, what did you think of the Quinn storyline?
Well, I think the Quinn storyline, I mean, you were just mentioning sort of the Mike White idea of what is the place of the white man? And I think this storyline explicitly sort of grapples with that, right? I mean, Steve Zahn's character is very aimless. He feels overshadowed by his wife. And then you have Quinn, who is sort of doing his best to be like we're in Hawaii, shouldn't we do some stuff that is Hawaiian? Like, shouldn't we be vaguely interested in where we are? And his mother continues being like, oh, well, white men have a really hard time right now and you should listen to him. But she never does. So I think the storyline is really an analysis of like liberal politics and sort of this sense of what is the infighting within people who say that they're liberal or people who say that they're progressive or say that they have sort of forward-thinking ideas and ideals. How do you actually live that, especially if you are this level of wealthy and sort of this level of detached? How do you actually put forth these things that you say that you value? And it's interesting to me that you said you thought Quinn was tragic, because I actually think he has the happiest ending.
Yeah, in some ways, yeah, but like, first of all, we don't know what happens, we don't see the aftermath. Like, basically what happens at the end, obviously, is he escapes his family. He's a minor. He's 16 years old.
Yeah.
So his family's going to pursue him and figure out where he is, you know?
Maybe.
They have considerable resources, Roxana, you know? He is the one that becomes like fully self-actualized and does what he wants at the end, on his own terms. And so that is good. But it's only because he's been kind of living this simulacrum of life prior to that, you know, like it's only because he doesn't feel at all fulfilled in anything that he's been doing before. And if he did, he wouldn't feel like he needs to take such drastic action. Now, maybe it's a good thing that he takes drastic action, you know, but to me, it just feels like he's in a very unloving family. And that's really sad, you know, or that doesn't recognize him for who he is, which is its own form of unloving, you know.
I think all of that is true. But I think that this show is sort of making, I think it's sort of making a case for what kind of drastic action actually gets results. And there's something sort of bleak about how much the other drastic actions fail. I mean, Paula's scheme fails. We'll get to Armand, his scheme fails. And I think the show is sort of doing an implicit, if you try to harm the system, it's not going to work. Wealth is too entrenched, class is too entrenched, power is too entrenched, and you can't, as an individual, alter that. The only thing you can do is leave, right? And that's what Quinn does. He just leaves. And I do respect that. You know, I think he probably, if we're saying that Shane was the most morally reprehensible, I do think that Quinn might be the one who's sort of baby politics I agree with the most.
Mm-hmm. I do think you bring up great points about the tension between trying to live out leftist politics or be a liberal and being incredibly rich.
Yeah.
And we see that play out, you know, in the conflict between the character of Nicole and her daughter, who's kind of a classic Gen Z. But what I really like about that relationship is the very final scenes where Olivia kind of reintegrates back into her family. And it's kind of a mirror of what happens with Rachel, where she's like, oh, like at the end of the day, we're all going to go back to the rich people we're related to, right? Like, no matter how many challenges we've gone through, no matter what, you know, at the end of the day, we're going to go back to the rich people we're related to. And there's this kind of inevitability. And I guess you're right that Quinn does break free of that. So,
and Olivia does something I think that Shane does. Like, Olivia does to Paula what Shane does to Rachel, which is, why don't you appreciate what I'm doing for you? Like, I think when Olivia finds out about Paula's sort of scheme to steal Olivia's mom's jewelry and sort of sell it, I think there is that conflict of, I brought you on this vacation and I'm doing something nice for you. Why would you sort of stab my family in the back? Which is exactly what Shane does with Rachel, right? I mean, there's this sort of incredulousness as to, why would you betray me? And it's not looking past the individual. It's not acknowledging that, well, the whole system is sort of wrong and I'm trying to do something to right the system.
Yeah.
So I think there's that part of it. I also think there's a lot of
obliviousness to the system, right? Like the injustices, the violence inherent in the system, basically, is kind of the things that they don't even recognize. And great point. Anyway, sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No. Well, all I was going to say is I remember at the time that people were sort of thinking Paula, did you really think you would get away with this? So I do think that is something sort of interesting to consider too. Paula's scheme is sort of childish, right? It is sort of immature. I mean, I don't think she has the tools to figure out how to actually work within this sort of infrastructure, sort of like you said. I mean, she's not someone like Rachel, who has like spent more time in these higher classes and who has sort of figured out how to navigate it. Paula, it seems like, is on this vacation, decides to do something impetuous, and her ending is very sad. I mean, again, she acquiesces, right? She surrenders to the system. She can't do anything against it.
Yeah. I completely agree. I mean, the thing is, as was pointed out in the actual show itself, the plan was a little bit too stupid, I think. Like,
yeah, it was a little bit too dumb.
Olivia says, like, hey, you wanted me to put this necklace in the thing, and then all of a sudden the next day it gets broken into and they know the code. Like, it makes no sense, you know.
No.
It did almost feel like more of a high school plot than a college, a college age person's plot. But anyway, I liked also, before we move on from the Mossbackers, I did like the kind of tension between Olivia and Paula, right? There's this kind of that Olivia, the Sydney Sweeney character, feels almost some kind of ownership over Paula, right? In a weird way throughout the season, that kind of comes out in these weird, spooky ways. So I like that. They didn't like say that much about it, but you could kind of feel it between the two of them, and it was in the performance. So just wanted to give that a shout out as well.
I also think it's worth saying that Steve Zahn is very funny. I mean, the Nicole and Mark storyline might have been on a little bit on the weaker end, just because I think that this sort of, oh, our relationship is imbalanced because of male and female gender roles, was a little bit more basic than I wanted from the show. But I think giving Connie Britton an opportunity to go against type and giving Steve Zahn some of the zanier, more deranged line deliveries as he's like reaching his limit of how much he'll take from his wife and from his daughter and from this stranger that's on the trip with them, I do think that he put forth a lot of the humor of the show in a very welcome way.
Hey, Roxana, let me try and take you down a mini rabbit hole here, okay? Because I'm trying to figure out like what the plot line with Mark and Nicole was trying to say. Mark spends most of the first season, I agree Steve Zahn's hilarious, but Mark spends most of the first season as kind of an ineffectual beta male, complaining about his station in life. And then he is reinvigorated when Kai thieves from their suite and then he like attacks him, and then like that makes him feel like a man again, right?
Right.
And my interpretation of it is, I don't think this is like, one of the messages of Fight Club, in my opinion, is that like this idea that like if you're a man, you know, that by getting in touch with your more primal aspects, like you can feel more fully actualized. I don't think this show is trying to say anything like that, because I don't think that, you know, he was in particularly very much danger, right? I think what the show is trying to say is that like, for somebody of this caste level, even a minor expression of masculinity is sufficient So that's kind of my interpretation. Like, it wasn't like what he did was particularly heroic, but it was like even just like a little bit of it is enough to kind of grease the wheels of this marriage, as it were. What do you think of that?
I think, yes. I mean, I agree. I think we see that exact same thing happen with Shane and Rachel, right? Because I think what happens to Armand is sort of predicated on Shane thinking, I need to protect my wife, I need to protect myself. I mean, protect yourself from a resort employee, you know what I mean? But I think that the whole element of crime in this series is a commentary on just how detached and rarefied these people have become. I mean, they're not used to minor inconvenience, they're not used to what is really just a petty crime. I mean, they're not used to any of that. So I think the opportunity to sort of be threatened again just becomes a way to reaffirm how special they are. I mean, Mark uses it as a way to prove his worth to his wife. that he doesn't feel worthy of in any other way.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't think it's actually saying this is an important thing that men need.
Right.
I think it's saying this is something that, again, just becomes commodified and sort of filtered through these class dynamics.
Or you need the taste of it, you know?
Yeah.
But you don't need the actual thing, whatever that actual thing might be, perhaps.
Right.
Anyway.
Right.
Okay, well, let's talk about Tanya, played by Jennifer Coolidge.
Favorite Tanya.
Obviously, delight. Very funny, you know, very goofy, very wacky. Love the random lines. She gets together with Greg, played by John Grease. And I really like this character and this plot line because it really shows, A, how much power wealthy people can wield over lesser people of lesser wealth, not only over their time, but also their attention and emotional resources. And also, like, how thoughtless they can be, right? Like, because it's not important for them, it's like they don't understand what it's like for someone in Belinda's position, who's played by Natasha Rothwell. That was the primary function of that storyline for me. What did you think of the Jennifer Coolidge-Tanya storyline?
Tanya was very complicated for me because she is sort of playing a little bit of a clown, right? I mean, everyone else at the resort sort of avoids her. They've seen that she's going through something and they don't want to deal with it. I mean, she sort of has become almost like this Miss Havisham figure, like haunting the resort and repelling other people. So I think the show sort of plays that for laughs a little bit, because Coolidge is sort of so good at those very simultaneously clueless and pointed sort of scenes. But again, yeah, I mean, I think what this storyline probably did the most is, you're right, it showed the thoughtlessness of her and how she could move through the world. But I also think that it did provide a focus on the flip side of that, right? I mean, somebody like Belinda, who has dreams but knows that her dreams need access to capital, and she needs to temper herself around this woman. She needs to befriend her. She needs to be available. I mean, she needs to basically rearrange her whole life to fit into what this woman needs so maybe she could have a shot at starting her own business. I thought what was really interesting about this is I think it's sort of a commentary on philanthropy in general, and especially like millionaire philanthropy, and the sense that, you know, if our economic system was better, you probably could get the funding to run your own business and you wouldn't have to sort of run through, you know, this obstacle course of
the whims of rich people. Like, it wouldn't be based off of the whims of rich people who just may or may not happen to feel like giving you money at that time, right?
Yeah. I mean, Tanya flip-flops, right? The entire season is her saying, this is a great idea. Somebody should do it. I don't know if it should be me, but somebody should do it. So I think this was probably, I think, the most pointed subplot about, like, a microcosm of something that's larger. And again, like, Natasha Rothwell is wonderful in this. Like, if people only knew her from Insecure, I think she does a really impactful job. And I think when I mentioned earlier that Daddario's end is sort of just heartbreaking, Rothwell's is too. I mean, arguably more, because, I mean, Daddario, Rachel gets to sort of go be wealthy. I mean, like, oh, it's so tragic. But, like, Natasha is left running this resort that she clearly hates.
There is this kind of Shakespearean tragedy element to Natasha getting shafted from Tanya. I like that Tanya gave her some money, so it wasn't like...
Sure.
It didn't make Tanya out to be like a complete monster, you know? Like, she gave her an envelope full of... It looked like she gave her a few $1,000 at least in there, you know?
But isn't that worse?
Like, yeah, I mean,
almost think that's
it's
worse.
Like, it's like dehumanizing in a way. Like, your time was worth this much, right?
Yes.
But so yes, I think that's very fair to say that that is an extremely clumsy and borderline insulting move to do, given like what Belinda was asking for. But there is something Shakespearean about the idea of like maybe Belinda, if Tanya hadn't treated Belinda so badly, like Belinda might have actually been there for Rachel and Rachel might not have gotten back with Shane, you know, right? That's the strong implication of the show. And
Belinda sort of gets punished. I mean, I do think in some way this show is sort of telling you, I don't want to say it does both sides, but I do think in some slight way, we're supposed to think, well, Belinda wanted it and she was wrong to want it. I don't know. Maybe that's reaching too far, but I think there's a slight element of that. Like all these rich people are terrible.
I think my interpretation is she was wrong to trust Tanya. Like that was my interpretation. It's like she wasn't wrong to want it, but she shouldn't have trusted Tanya because she went all in. She was like, yes, Tanya's going to answer my dreams. I'm like, there's no way that's going to happen. Like I knew from the outset that was not going to happen for her. So like, hopefully she's going to be smarter next time around. And you know, that was one of the most brutal scenes was after Belinda, you know, talks to Tanya, talks to Rachel. She's then like getting up on the, you know, on the, rock face or whatever and waving at the next crew that's coming in and smiling. And I think that's one of the great things about the show is it does help you understand how dehumanizing the service industry is, you know?
Yeah.
And how much we expect of our essential workers.
And how cyclical, right?
Yeah,
I mean, the demand is you do this day in and day out. I mean, you don't have variation. You are purely existent on, as you said, the whims of others.
Yeah. To go back to just that, the final point about the Shakespearean nature of like Belinda, you know, gets upset by Tanya and then like gives, you know, doesn't want to help out Rachel. Like almost it feels like the message of that is that the system of, you know, people who are privileged oppressing or disregarding those who are under them, like helps to reinforce the existing system in a weird way, which is like way, right? It was that Belinda being hurt then could not help Rachel get out of the system, you know, in that scenario. I don't know how common that like specific set of circumstances is, but you know, it is like thematically does fit in a little bit. So,
right. And I mean, I think again, it's like, why is it Belinda's place to help Rachel do that?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah,
so it's about how like much emotional labor people expect for free, right? And like that's another theme that runs throughout the season.
Yeah.
But let's talk about some of those workers, right? Specifically, we got to talk about Armand, who is the star of the show. I mean, what an amazing performance! I didn't know who Murray Bartlett was before this season began, and I was just completely blown away. And he is so good in the season one finale as well, with the dinner scene where he's like greeting everyone for dinner. It's in ultra slow motion. It's like amazing, you know. But he has the sense of this guy who both has a great customer service voice, like "Hello, welcome to the White Lotus," and also is barely keeping it together behind the scenes. And just what a wonderful, richly textured performance. Obviously, somebody who has a tragic end. I want to talk about the murder mystery element. But before we get to that, overall thoughts on Armand?
Yeah, I mean, Armand is amazing. Again, it's a very smart thing to make the show begin with his error. Because I think then, as viewers, we're thinking of, okay, well, he's overworked. He's a lot of stuff going on. This place is demanding too much. He made a mistake. How can he, quote unquote, fix it? Is there anything he can do to fix it? So I think as we're following him around on this journey, at a certain point, I think the show flips your perspective from thinking, how is he going to fix it, to he really shouldn't have to fix it. Like, who cares? And I think Murray Bartlett, the power of his performance is sort of making you go from, they're right, the patents are right, and they deserve something, to even if the patents are right, they don't deserve it. And you sort of understand why Armand would think that after all of these years of working at this place and seeing these kind of people. But Bartlett's performance is amazing. I mean, he just switches on a dime between these character traits. And I think, you know, we've talked about how wonderful everyone is, and everyone is wonderful, but I do think that performance is probably the most indicative of what White is trying to say about what these jobs do to you over time. Because it's not a career, right? It's
well, it can be, but I think it's a very precarious one. You know, as his trajectory in this season shows, you can piss off one rich person and then your career is over. Like that's kind of what we see taking place. And as a viewer, you are just enraged by the injustice of it all. You know, and so like that a POS like Jake Lacy's character should be the one that wields the power in this situation. It doesn't make any sense. You know, it doesn't make any sense. But it is the system that we live in. So, it's you know the final scenes of the episode are shocking. He decides to go back to Jake Lacy's character's room and take a crap in the suitcase. They actually show it coming out, which I was stunned by. I was like, wow, that's, I don't think I've seen that in a TV show in a pretty long time. And then he's stabbed and by accident, you know, and then and killed. The episode began with a murder mystery type, or the season began with a murder mystery type deal where you're like, who is in the casket? And I did appreciate how the show head faked you many times. Like, John Grease's character, Greg, has a heavy cough. And in general, when a character has a cough on a TV show, they're going to die. Like, that's 99% of the time if you
Downton
see a character
Abbey.
Coughing.
Don't get a cough.
They're going to die, right?
Don't cough.
So, yeah, it's like, is it going to be John Grease's character? Is it going to be Shane doing some dumb stuff? Is it going to be Kai who, like, accidentally gets caught up in the robbery? So you don't know who's going to die until the very end. And thematically, it does make sense that Armand is the one to die. I mean, he is the one that in the construct of the show, or in the construct of this system of capitalism, basically, his life is quote unquote worthless. I don't feel that way, but I think the show is basically saying like, these are people whose fates can be just decided at a whim without any consideration by complete dipshits. So inherently they are worthless. And the show kind of makes that point with a stirring finality by killing the character of Armand. Now I am kind of curious, like, you know, so I thought the murder mystery stuff worked fine. Like throughout the season, they weren't like multiple times an episode cutting to the casket and being like, I wonder who it is. You know, like
who is it?
It was like fairly subtle. So that was good about it. I was also curious, but it was like one of the things that like kept me watching.
Of course.
I am curious, like in season two, I don't think there's going to be a murder mystery is my guess, because that would be a little bit too coincidental. But I wonder if there's some other similar construct there. Anyway, so
I think what'll be interesting is to see how does this show function as an anthology, right? I mean, my understanding was that it became an anthology after the very successful season one, which was like a Big Little Lies thing that happened. So I think it's just a matter of like, what connective tissue is it? We know there's going to be a resort. Presumably, there are going to be a lot of rich people. But is it like a Hangover 2 type situation where everything is identical, but we're just in a different place? Yeah, I'm really curious to what level of sort of mimicry or recreation we're going to get.
Yeah, that's a great question. I will tell you that I have been to the actual filming location of The White Lotus, season one. And this will probably be my last opportunity to talk about it in a way that makes any sense. It was completely fascinating, Roxana, because there were probably, I am not exaggerating, I probably saw approximately 1,000 people when I was there. And like, it is just packed to the gills with people.
Wow.
I went in like summer, fall of 2021, basically.
Okay.
And it was like the show makes it seem like, oh, this is a tiny, intimate resort with
small.
100 to 200 people. I mean, there were hundreds upon hundreds of people. There's also a wedding going on at the time we were there. So it was like, but like I'm saying, there was like hundreds of people separate from the wedding. Like,
right.
It was just like overwhelmingly large quantity of people. So I was actually incredibly impressed with how they're able to make it look so small. Now, they shot it during COVID, and apparently everyone just stayed at the resort. So, you know, like...
That makes sense.
Yeah, that was helpful. But I agree with you. I'm also very curious, like, it doesn't feel like a second season that was born out of, like, I had another story to tell necessarily, because it was always intended to be a limited series, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. And so you're in the danger zone already, because... There have been times, True Detective season 2, great example, where like season 2 was like rushed to production, and the scripts were not in a good state, you know. And
well,
so
I have such mixed feelings on True Detective season 2. Mm-hmm. I think that I've liked it more each time I've rewatched it, but I can't figure out if I'm convincing myself of that or if it's actually like good. It's hard to tell. It's hard to say.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah.
Were there any moments at the resort where you were like, oh, hey, that place from that scene?
Yes, yes. Tons of moments. Like, you know, the place where they eat breakfast every day is like, I don't think it's actually a restaurant in the real resort. The place where Quinn like sits and, goes to sleep every night, you know, on the beach, it's like very easy to, it's very accessible. And I'm like, it's the place and it looks exactly the same. And so, you know, the place where the Pattons hang out, you know, near the bar and everything like that, that's all there. It's all there. So it's like, you know, unlike some places where or some shows where you watch it and you go to the place and it looks nothing like it, it's like, wow, it is identical, except the real place is way, way, way bigger. And because it's way bigger, it's a little bit less nice feeling than what's on the show. Like what's in the show feels like a very boutique, like, you know. I should point out, I did not actually stay there. I just like went there and kind of looked around because I had heard. And it's just, you know, instead of the White Lotus, it says the Four Seasons there, you know. It was a fascinating experience to go. But to the point of what season two is, like, what are the themes going to be? And is a luxury hotel resort that has locations around the world enough to hang a multi-season show on is the question.
Right.
Like, is that enough of a unifying factor? Will it explore other realms of privilege? You know, is kind of what my question is. So we will
and
be finding
will
out here.
The place,
yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. And like, and will the place where it's set sort of have more of a role to play? Like, are we going to talk more about tourism and whether it's exploitative for the people who live there? I mean, are we going to do the class thing again? Or are we going to sort of expand? Are we going to do more of how do men feel manly or any of that sort of thing? I mean, there are various subplots that we could pull on. Something that we didn't really talk about but that I think is interesting is that Armand, before he sort of meets his untimely, sad end, is sort of a nightmare boss. Like, he's sort of been trained by White Lotus to almost treat his employees also as sort of replaceable. And so I'm curious, too, if we get more of a commentary on how do people who work in these places treat each other, too? Like, does that kind of dismissiveness from the wealthy trickle down? I would be curious about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think that the show didn't really do enough on the, you know, when it came to the perspective of whether or not tourism is exploitative, you know, and specifically with Hawaii, which is quite controversial. I'm going to be honest with you, like, after I made that trip to Hawaii, during which I visited the Four Seasons, aka the White Lotus, I had a bit of a crisis of conscience of not knowing if it was okay to go to Hawaii anymore. You know, like,
right.
I think that there's many people who live on Hawaii that are like, please don't come anymore. You know, like, we don't want the tourism anymore. And it's like, who are we to say no to that? So it was something that I thought about, and it was something that I didn't think the show really explored at all. Like, it made reference vaguely to the fact that, like, there were native peoples that have rituals, but it doesn't examine the injustice of any of this at all.
Right. It had Kai's family, right?
Yes.
Their land was taken from them.
Yeah.
And Paula's whole deal is that she wants to steal the jewelry to help Kai get a lawyer, et cetera, et cetera. But again, the jewelry was worth $75,000. Paula, that's not enough. That's not going to help you in a land war. That's not going to work. So, poor Paula. She didn't know any better.
I will say I have been invited to Hawaii, and I'm planning to go in early November by a Hawaiian organization to be part of a film festival there. And so that I'm extremely excited about, because I'm like, oh, like I can actually go relatively guilt-free because, you know, I'm being invited there. But yeah, in general, and by the way, I should point out there are ways to visit Hawaii responsibly, you know, and I've since learned more about what that is. But I do think that is a legacy of the show, is that I do think, for me, there are shows that like have a really strong perspective on right and wrong, like The Wire, you know, and there are shows that have that are good at like bringing up questions, and this show did both. But like, even if it didn't take a position on visiting Hawaii very strongly, you know, like or oppression of Native people or things of that nature, it still got me to think about them. You know, it's still like by the nature of depicting them, I'm like, oh, now I want to think about, I want to explore that more. I want to dig into that more, whether or not that was intentional or unintentional on the show's part. But I do appreciate that. So even when I say the commentary was lacking on that subject, I still appreciate the show for even kind of bringing it up at all.
Just sort of a coincidence of timing is that this came out still when people were, I think, doing a little bit more about COVID precautions. So you still had portions of the country who were doing more like masking and staying inside and sort of self-quarantining and all that stuff. And you also still had a bunch of people who were traveling all the time and just not changing how they lived. So I think it was interesting for me as well to sort of watch a show that asked you to consider what are the people that you're forcing to work for you on these vacations, what are they dealing with and what are they going through? And during COVID, that was relevant. And I think just any time that's relevant. So I appreciated the show for, like you said, offering up those questions and forcing them to sort of tackle them.
Have you been in the service industry before, Roxanne? Are you or your family been in the service industry? I'm curious.
My
dad was owned and ran a Chinese restaurant for almost 2 decades, during which my brother and I worked there for many years. So like I'm very as like cashier and stuff like that. So like I'm very familiar with, you know, what it's like to work at a restaurant and do like all the jobs at a restaurant. Other than cooking.
I did restaurant stuff. I mean, it was like Panera, Baskin Robbins, like summer type of things. And then my partner does some service industry stuff and worked at Starbucks in high school. So we both have those experiences where you have sort of the nightmare customer, right? Mm-hmm. Mine was the woman at Baskin Robbins who was on the phone and let her child order anything he wanted. And he ordered Reese's peanut butter cup ice cream. And then she blamed me that I didn't know that he was allergic to peanut butter. So, you know, like everybody has a version of that type of story.
Who side Roxanna's going to be on for the White Lotus season 2.
Yeah, I'm going to be on the don't let your child order ice cream that might harm them side. So, yeah, maybe we'll get that. Who knows?
Yeah, indeed. Well, this has been so wonderful, Roxanna, to chat with you about the show. I'm so excited to dive into season 2 with you. And again, you can expect episodes to come out at podcast.decodingtv.com within a couple days after the show airs on HBO on Sunday nights. Until next time, Roxanna, you want to tell people where they can find more of your work in the meantime?
Sure. You can find my work at Vulture. You can find me on Twitter. And, you know, just that's it. That's my corner of the internet.
All right. We'll link to those in the show notes. But if you want to let us know what you think of The White Lotus and what you're looking forward to, decodingtv@gmail.com. Also follow us on Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube @decodingtv. She is Roxanna Haddadi. I am David Chen. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you for next week's episode, the season premiere of The White Lotus season 2. Goodbye.
Bye.